On This Week in Enterprise Tech, malware makers lawyer up, quantum computing for kids, VMware protects your apps, and Chris Mitchell from the Institute for Local Self-Reliance drops by to give you hope post-net neutrality. Twiet on the set.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twiet.
Bandwidth for This Week in Enterprise Tech is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twiet, This Week in Enterprise Tech, episode 269, recorded December 15, 2017, after net neutrality. This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you by GoToWebinar, a trusted webinar platform with over 55,000 customers who have hosted over 2.7 million interactive web events to connect with their audiences. For more, visit GoToWebinar.com/podcast. And by Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully so that you can be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. Get started at rocketmortgage.com/enterprise. Welcome to Twiet. This Week in Enterprise Tech, it's the show dedicated to the enterprise professional, the IT pro, and the geek who just wants to know how the world is connected. I'm your host, Father Robert Ballazer, the digital Jesuit, your guide to all things in the enterprise. But of course, I cannot guide you by myself. It's an awfully big and complicated world. I'm going to need a little help from my friends, specifically Mr. Lou Maresca. He is a senior bigwig. That's an actual title that's on his card. Senior bigwig over at Microsoft. Lou, it's so good to see you, my friend. I see you're coming to us from home today.
Indeed, yeah, I'm doing well. I'm on vacation for the rest of the year now, so I get to be home a little bit with my kids and do some reading and some projects, and it'll be good.
By the way, I've noticed that our 2D is having fun with your lower third because you are now Debug Dog.
I like that one.
That's pretty good. Senior Bigwig. Oh, see, that's how fast he is. He can just come up with these things. He just puts them in there. Well, Lou, we've got a great show. Not only are we going to be covering a little bit of the news, and not only are we going to be talking a little bit about VMware, but in the middle segment, we've got a special treat for all those people who are still reeling from the defeat of net neutrality. But as we always do, we got to kick it off with the blips. Now, malware is bad. That's not a surprise. We all know that. But you know what's worse than malware? Malware with a legal team. That's what Amit Serper, the principal security researcher at security analytics company CyberReason, ran into when he discovered OS X Pirate, an active malware campaign that is currently infecting tens of thousands of Macs. The adware, which was built by Targeting Edge, an Israeli-based company that develops ad technology, is an installer package that can piggyback any number of tools. Once it asks for and receives the user permissions to install, it pulls down additional components from Targeting Edge that can be used to hijack browsers, push up ad counts, use Apple Script to directly serve ads into browsers instead of proxy hijacking, all the way to root access. Now, Serper wrote up his findings and crafted a detailed report describing the malware's infection vectors, capabilities, and the steps it takes to disguise its activity. He posted the research, then received a cease and desist from the malware company. Targeting Edge sent a scathing letter to CyberReason claiming that they make legitimate ad-serving software that is in no way, shape, or form related to OS X Pirate. One problem: a former Targeting Edge employee had tried to gain employment at CyberReason, and in his application, he had included the fact that he wrote OS X Pirate for Targeting Edge. If you've got time, I recommend dropping by the CyberReason report listed in our show notes. It's a fascinating read.
You rely on email, I rely on email, but I've always been kind of a skeptic when it comes to trusting email, but it looks like researchers have found a way for email to be even less trustworthy. The Mailsploit attack developed by researchers is an array of methods for spoofing email in more than a dozen common email clients, including Apple Mail for iOS, macOS, Mozilla's Thunderbird, Microsoft Mail, Outlook 2016, as well as a long list of less common clients, including Opera Mail, Airmail, Smart, Gorilla Mail, and AOL Mail. By combining the bugs in the email clients with quirks in operating systems, how they handle certain kinds of texts, researchers were able to craft email headers that, to the recipient, given every indication of having sent from whatever address the hacker chooses. This creates an even greater potential for undetectable and successful phishing campaigns. The mail exploit attack lets anyone send emails from any address by choosing whatever they want. Imagine thinking you can get an email from POTUS@whitehouse.gov or mom@hotmail.com or myboss@mywork.com or any other corporate executive, politician, friend, family member, or even associate. Getting an email from them and thinking it's from them and not being able to do anything about it. Thanks to Mailsploit's tricks, no amount of scrutiny in the email client can reveal the faker. Email systems have adapted over the years, developing systems like DMARC that would filter out spoofed emails when headers don't match where it was sent from. Most phishers today use lookalike domains to trick email receivers to think it's actually coming from the real domain, like twitter.com without two T's. While Mailsploit's tricks defeat DMARC and systems like it, researchers informed all the major players, with Apple and Microsoft reporting they're on their way to fixing some of these things. But Microsoft also stated that Outlook.com and Office 365 and Exchange 2016 are not affected by this Mailsploit. If there's any good time to start digitally signing your email, now would be it, because Mailsploit is a coming.
Remember Mirai? That's the botnet that crippled the internet last October by using compromised Linux devices to launch massive DDoS attacks against DNS. Well, at the time, it was a perfect storm of vulnerabilities and manufacturer laziness. A malware that continuously scans for poorly protected IoT devices, uses a list of default usernames and passwords, some of which could not be changed, and was so virulent that cleaned devices could be reinfected in a matter of minutes. It infected 65,000 devices in the first 20 hours, then doubled in size every 76 minutes until it reached 600,000 infections. Mirai was able to launch a sustained multi-day 620 gigabit per second DDoS attack on Krebs on Security and a 1 terabit per second attack on French web host OVH, and all but brought dying DNS to its knees. There was talk that this could have been a nation-state-backed attack, or perhaps a practice run for disrupting the 2016 elections, but as it turned out, it was a bunch of college kids who were trying to DDoS Minecraft servers. Yep, Paris Jha, Josiah White, and Dalton Norman admitted their role in creating and launching Mirai in an attempt to shake down Minecraft server operators before becoming DDoS for hire purveyors. The defendants will have the book thrown at them, but the damage is done. Mirai has gone on to spawn dozens of clones and copycats, and with the state of IoT as it is currently, it may be decades before the work of three college students looking to beat Minecraft finally disappears.
Well, we can't stay away from it, and this past week, net neutrality was the topic to talk about, but some states are just not going to accept the outcome. Governor Jay Inslee, Attorney General Bob Ferguson, and other officials announced a plan today to maintain standards in Washington state that would require internet providers to offer the same speed services for all online content. Inslee's plan would start by directing Washington's Utilities and Transportation Commission, the UTC, to establish certification that internet companies can acquire by complying with the net neutrality principles. Without that certification, the state would not provide benefits like easements and use of UTC poles. Washington is around one of the first states to, quote, proactively protect net neutrality, according to Inslee. Comcast has repeatedly said it does not plan to block, throttle, or discriminate against lawful content. Verizon has echoed this statement, but some states are not going to take their word for it anymore. Now, a bit of food for thought. If states start enforcing their own rules, which vary per state, could ISPs start to punish the state with less optimal service? Think about it.
I don't want to think about it. In fact, I want to just concentrate on security vendors in the San Francisco Bay Area, because it was a double bad dose of news this week for those vendors here in the Bay Area. But not all vendors, just Fortinet and Palo Alto Networks. Fortinet's Fortinet VPN client suffers from CVE-2017-14184, which allows attackers to extract VPN credentials. The problem is that the client stores VPN credentials in a file, which is encrypted with a key that unfortunately is baked into the client binary and can be extracted with minimal effort. For their part, Palo Alto Networks acknowledge that their PAN OS suffers from CVE-2017-14184, 15944, which allows remote code execution and root access if the WAN management interface is left enabled. The flaws aren't just a black eye for security vendors that generally have a good reputation for weeding out these sorts of vulnerabilities in the pen test phase, but actual active in the wild exploits that are being exploited right now. Bottom line, go patch.
If you want to take a quantum leap forward into the next generation of computing and programming, you might want to try the new programming language Q#. In classical computers, a bit can only exist in a binary state of on or off, whereas with quantum programs, a qubit, the quantum equivalent of a bit, can exist in multiple states at the same time. This past week, Microsoft released their first ever quantum computing development kit. The kit includes a starter's guide for learning how the new programming language Q# works and its compiler, as well as a local quantum computing simulator and a quantum trace simulator, and a Visual Studio extension to help tie it all together. The ability to program quantum computers as a high-level language opens the door to programs that simply just couldn't exist before that. Microsoft is joining companies like IBM, who has a quantum computer service available for programmers, and last month it had a breakthrough with the release of 20-qubit quantum computer. The company also announced a 50-qubit prototype coming. Even though this field of computer science is still new, I've already convinced my kids that Minecraft could be programmed with it in the future, so get a moving to learning some Q#.
Now, you could make all the jokes you want about AOL and the many disastrous incarnations of the company since it was bought by Time Warner at the top of its life cycle. And yes, the company has had some really, really bad leadership over the years, and it squandered what could have been an insurmountable lead for the trinkets of the day. It could have been a Google, but it ended up an AOL. Still, AOL did change the world with a little service called AOL Instant Messenger. Looking back, that simple program was a crystal ball into the future of how we communicate. Alas, even that is now gone. As of today, AIM is shutting down. Your screen name is permanently AFK. Your buddy list will unfriend you. Your contacts will be disconnected and your chat logs will log out. When you think about how much of today's enterprise communications are patterned after those early chat clients, perhaps you'll be with me to pour one out to say goodbye to AIM. That does it for the bits. Next up, we've got, a special bite. But before we get to that, let's go ahead and thank a sponsor of this episode of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Now, this episode of TWiET is brought to you by GoToWebinar. It's the webinar platform that hosted 2.7 million web of interactive events per year. Now, GoToWebinar believes webinars are one of the best ways to interact with your prospects and customers. Instead of business presentations or company websites, I mean, who wants to see more PDFs or get PowerPoint poisoning? What you want is something that's new, something that's dynamic, something that's interactive. What you want is GoToWebinar. Now, with GoToWebinar, you can create custom email invitations, confirmations, and reminders, or let GoToWebinar handle it all with automated email templates. You can display your company logo and custom image on all webinar materials. You could create and schedule pre-recorded webinars that are as interactive as live events. And, of course, it's mobile-friendly. You can schedule a webinar, edit a session, or track performance from your iOS or Android device. You can create up to 20 polls before the session or on the fly for audience interaction based on what you see. You can add up to 20 questions to a survey and engage participants with Q&A. You can engage your audience with more than one presenter and panelist. For up to six panelists can share their webcams and participate face-to-face. You can broadcast a view of your desktop or specific applications. In other words, you can do it the way that you want to do it. And with GoToWebinar's reporting and analytics, you're just a click away from qualified leads, metrics, and data to improve your webinars. You'll have end-to-end 128-bit AES encryption, and of course, they're rated number one in customer satisfaction. So here's what we want you to do. We want you to turn your next presentation into a conversation with GoToWebinar. For more information, visit gotowebinar.com/podcast. That's gotowebinar.com/podcast. And we thank GoToWebinar for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. We've got a special treat for you. Instead of a standard bite, we thought that we should bring a guest in to talk about something which obviously is of big concern to us today. That was yesterday, the FCC voting along party lines 3-2 to drop the net neutrality regulations. Now, we could go into a song and dance about why it's a bad idea. I could give you survival techniques for explaining what all of this means to your family as you go home to the for the holidays. But we're going to do that next week. Instead, I want to give you some measures that might help you look into the future. Perhaps a way to respond to what's going on if you are an advocate of net neutrality. And that is perhaps to build out your own networks. That's why I'm going to welcome back to the show a guest who was last on Twiit this past March, Mr. Christopher Mitchell. He is the from the Institute of Local Self-Reliance. He's the Director of Community Broadband Networks Initiative with the ILSR. Chris, did I get that all right? Because you've got a really long title.
Yes, you nailed it. Thank you.
Fantastic. Well, Chris, the last time that you were on, the ILSR and the whole Community Broadband Initiative was interesting. And it was something that I liked, something that I was very much promoting. But it was more of a curiosity. It's like, oh, okay, the municipal networks, that might be a good idea. With the end of net neutrality, it actually takes on a more urgent tone, wouldn't you say? I mean, what's the interaction between municipalities and cities and towns building up their own networks versus what we're seeing from the FCC?
Well, we're definitely seeing a lot more interest in this. And in particular, we're seeing that on Twitter, where there's a lot of people freaking out and asking, what can we do? I like to say that municipal networks are not a replacement for network neutrality, in that we really want to see network neutrality policy upheld for everyone. But if in a world in which we do not have network neutrality, if you have a community network, that's going to be great refuge, because most of these community networks have no interest. In fact, I was just talking to someone who runs a small network, which almost all municipal networks are, and he said that the cost of adding equipment to traffic shape would be far greater than any revenue. So in general, you wouldn't expect small wired networks to engage in this activity at all in terms of discriminating based on content.
All right. In the past, we've heard stories of little towns, particularly those ones who are not well served by the large telcos, deciding, hey, if you're not going to serve us, if you're not going to give us broadband, if you actually think that we'll all be happy with just dial-up speeds, we're going to do it ourselves. And there was a huge fight every single time one of these cities has decided to do this. An incumbent will come in, and even though they refuse to serve the area, they'll say, you can't do this. This is not allowed. Why is that? Give me the background. Let's backtrack all the way back. Why is it such a big story every time a municipality decides to build out its own network?
Well, it's a big story because the incumbents don't face a lot of competition. In fact, we've been running some numbers because of net neutrality. And to give you a specific example, California has 39 million people. Like a quarter of them only have one option for broadband. But among those who have a choice, about 20% of those, which is to say that if you look at the entire population of California, half of the people of California can only choose to get broadband from one or two firms that are big national companies that have a history of violating net neutrality. When you have that kind of market power, when you basically control half of California, you don't want to have to worry about competition. And so they will respond to any threat of competition in the strongest manner they can. When a local government is proposing competition, the best thing you can do to try and stop it is to shout socialism and say, right, you know, this is unfair competition. So that's why that argument happens. But when you look at the big companies, they respond to competition in a similar way, no matter who it comes from. They just try to find the most effective argument for their given opponent.
Right. You know, there is an interesting interaction between a law from 1980, the 1980 Cable Policy Act, 1984, I'm sorry, which tried to push the deployment of these networks. If for those of us who were around back in the 80s, you may remember that we were still all OTA. Unless you lived in a large metro area, we got all of our content over the air, broadcast, and it was a way to try to entice companies to come in and put down the money needed to deploy. Now, in that 1984 Act, in that policy piece, we essentially said, we will give you right of way. We will give you this functional monopoly. But, and this is specifically spelled out in the Act, you have to work for the greater good of the community. Unfortunately, that wasn't really well defined. It was sort of nice words that have fallen to the wayside. What is in the 1984 Act that might allow for a municipality to say, look, you've shirked your duty. You haven't lived up to that act. Now it's our opportunity to step in and do your job for you.
Well, the 1984 Act certainly gave cities the authority to engage in monopoly franchises. Most cities, I think, in fact, pursued that. And that's why roughly 85-90% of America has access to cable networks. Because if for a cable network to build in a city, they had to build to everyone. That was one of the requirements, typically. Now, that law was superseded in 1996 by the Telecommunications Act of 1996 with the various amendments.
Right.
And so the ability of cities to give exclusive franchises for either telephone or video services was greatly limited. And since then, half of the states have actually limited the authority of local governments to give any kind of franchise. And no one's allowed to give an exclusive franchise. So to the extent that you live in a city that can negotiate franchises today, first of all, it's kind of rare. Second of all, the city is very limited in what it can ask for. Now, I think there's some good reasons for we could argue about positive and negative reactions from that. But when I hear, as is inevitable in the chat room for Twitch shows, for instance, somebody saying, well, it's government franchises that are restricting competition, I kind of want to light my hair on fire. I get a little bit upset.
Me too.
Because we tried exclusive franchises. They had some good effects. They had some negative effects. Now we're in a period where we're not using exclusive franchises, but we've found that the just natural economics of building these networks is such that there are still monopolies, even if government is not protecting them. Although, frankly, you and I could spend an hour talking about some of the ways in which the federal government is doing things around the edges to help AT&T and Comcast. But the broader point is really that even if we didn't have government, we would probably still have these telecom monopolies because it just makes sense for Wall Street to corner these markets because you can make so much money with a monopoly. That trumps any urge for competition.
Right, right. Unfortunately, that's absolutely the truth. I want to bring my co-host into this. He's been sort of chomping at the bit. I see him in the preview menu and he's just like, What? Lou, one of the curious things about municipal networks is that at some point, they still need to link up to the backbone, right?
Right. I mean, that was my question I was posing to you in the chat there was the fact that, you know, there's a couple of them here in the Pacific Northwest. Like there's the Issaquah Highland Network, which is a fiber network, but they're all backboned by CenturyLink. So that means that even at some point, if they decide to bring back fast lanes, they could still do it at the baseline at the network itself. And it seems to me that it will affect even these private networks, these municipal networks that are developed, like the one in Issaquah here in the Pacific Northwest. So I guess what made me question back to Christopher is this actually a concern for networks like that?
Oh, yeah. And you named CenturyLink, which is a big concern. You know, it's just worth noting that Washington is one of the few states that has dramatically good backhaul options because of something called the Northwest Open Access Network, NOAANet, which is a large presence across the state and gives cities and local governments, local businesses, wireless towers, additional options for backhaul. But your larger point is right, especially across the United States. CenturyLink just bought Level 3, which means here in the Midwest, the company that supplied access to a lot of smaller towns was Level 3 because CenturyLink was offering prohibitive prices in those places. But the federal government just let CenturyLink buy Level 3. Level 3 was also one of the largest lobbyists in favor of network neutrality in the past. Verizon recently bought XO Communications, a company kind of like Level 3 that also was a big proponent of the open internet. And so we see large monopolies gobbling up one of the few sources of big money in D.C. in favor of open internet. So that's really concerning. But this idea of how to get on the open internet is something that's going to get worse as we've seen the backbone networks become more and more consolidated.
Yeah,
I thought we were going to keep it happy though today.
This is happy. This is happy in this sense. What I think is a very unique opportunity for groups like the ILSR and the Broadband Initiative is you might be able to frame the conversation differently. As you already mentioned, one of the biggest, easiest ways to derail the municipal network conversation is to say socialism. Just scream out socialism and people will pull back. This is different. This is, hey, okay, if you want the ISPs to operate in a capitalist market, then they have to have competition. We're willing to give them competition. How do you frame the conversation like that? How do you say, hey, look, we'll go with your decision, but we want true competition. We want everyone to have at least two options for real broadband so that that will keep them from doing the things that we're accusing them of doing.
It's a really good question, and we see that the conversation goes a little differently in different communities. But we've found, and there's been national polling, that about 7 out of 10 Americans, regardless of political affiliation, believes that the decision of whether to build a municipal network or some form of community network should be made locally. And one of the things we've been trying to highlight on our site, muninetworks.org, lately is what the options are. And something I think your audience may be interested in is something we've seen in both Longmont and Fort Collins, Colorado, which is local organizations springing up, kind of impromptu groups that call themselves Broadband and Beers or something like that. They'll meet at a pub and have some beers and talk about these issues. And over time, they form a coalition of sorts. There's some guys from Fort Collins that are frequently active on Twitter now, Glenn Atkins and Colin Garfield, who, if you look at some of the stuff we've written about Fort Collins, you'll find the ways of contacting them. But they're very happy to share their idea of how to have these conversations with people. And fundamentally, what it comes down to is wanting to do something, because one of the things that we're seeing after the vote to repeal net neutrality is that people go from thinking, community network, that's be a really good idea, it'd be kind of nice, to saying, yeah, let's make it happen. What do we have to do? Let's go out there and do it.
Yeah. At the very minimum, this is your hedge. This is the only thing that you can hold over an ISP. If you go to Comcast and you say, you know, I really don't like the fact that you're blocking this and this website, and I don't like the fact that I have to pay more if I don't want you to slow down my VPN or whatever is going to happen, that discussion goes away if instead I can go to Comcast and say, well, I'm just going to sign up with them. I'm just going to promote my own network. That fixes a lot of things. In this sense, you are right in line with some very traditional conservatives of let the market decide. This lets the market decide, but it takes away that functional monopoly that was granted to these telcos in the first place. Lou, let me get you in here. I mean, is this doable? Do you actually see this, or is this another pie in the sky project? Could enough municipalities get together like we just saw in Colorado? Could enough towns and cities finally say enough is enough? We're willing to put a little bit of money into this project to make sure that we at least have something to threaten the telcos when they don't want to serve our community.
You know, I'm on the camp that the home internet, that the hardline internet is on its way out. And I think that because the fact that is the case, especially in the case where I live, people are pushing for just better wireless technology, better wireless internet, especially on their cell phones, being able to share, tether, that kind of thing. And, you know, again, this affects those companies as well. And there's no easy way to do a municipal wireless system. So I think I think the problem lies there, is that people will rely more and more on their mobile devices and on mobile internet, and they'll put less efforts into the hardline internet and the local internet, unless you're a small business. And so that's going to be part of it. But and on the second case is, yes, I do think that adding competition into the realm, like in fact, by the Issaquah Highlands doing what they did, they have the Highlands are a separate part of Issaquah. It was the city of Issaquah, which only has Comcast and CenturyLink. And they, just by having Comcast and CenturyLink in that area, they kind of fight back and forth for pricing, especially on the gigabit internet. And, you know, when the Highlands came in and said, hey, $30, you get gigabit fiber, CenturyLink and Comcast had to drop their prices even more because people were just moving to the Highlands just to get the internet. So I think that's definitely going to help going in the long run for sure.
Right. Oh, Chris, what about that? I let's take that first part specifically, which is wired versus wireless. The FCC themselves, they made a very interesting move a couple of weeks ago when they were trying to essentially say, well, as long as there's wireless bandwidth out in those rural areas, we don't really need to force the telcos to do the thing that they promised to do, which is provide them wired service. Does that hamper the effort at all when you can have a company say, well, I mean, you can get decent service on your cell phone, so I guess we really don't have to wire your neighborhood?
So there's a couple of reactions. One is that in 1996, one of the things that we expected was this incredible competition between wired services and wireless and broadband over power lines and municipalities. And the incumbents found ways of locking a lot of that competition down or buying it up. I do not see wireless suddenly providing the competition that was promised 21 years ago. Wireless is wonderful, and we're going to increasingly use wireless devices, but the wireless has to be backhauled by something. Right. I gave up video games for a while. I bought an Xbox One. I threw Final Fantasy 15 on it. I have downloaded in the past 3 weeks 50 gigabytes worth of patches. I'm not going to be doing that on a wireless device. And fundamentally, there's different wireless technologies, so I don't want to throw it all out. But wireline fiber optics is actually the cheapest technology for deploying internet access over a period of multiple decades. We keep talking about wireless because we think it'll be cheaper over the next 5 years. But over the next 30 years, it's incredibly expensive. It has a high operating cost. It has to be replaced every 3 to 5 years. Fiber is really expensive up front, but over 30 years, it actually is really cheap. So I think we're going to continue to see fiber optics being rolled out and used, even though people are going to use more and more wireless devices on their wireless access points locally.
Yeah, Lou, that's always been one of those frustrating things for me, because we've got a savvy audience. The people who listen or watch this show understand how networking technology works. And yet that one little basic piece, that wireless will never be as good as wired as far as reliability and overall bandwidth, it eludes so many conversations. I mean, again, I'm with Chris. Wireless is fantastic. I love the convenience of wireless. Wireless is not going anywhere. Wireless will be part of every deployment strategy from here on out. However, you are filling the air with RF energy. There is a finite limit to how much you can put into the air at the same time and still have an intelligible connection, versus fiber or any physical connection where you can essentially get full bandwidth over every connection that you lay. It seems such a simple concept to grasp. And yet we still have people who I would consider very intelligent and very good in this industry say, well, wireless is going to solve. How do you account for that disconnect?
I think the first thing you said is we have a very intelligent, tech-savvy audience, and I do agree with that. I think, but the rest of the world isn't, right? I think the moms and pops of the world, especially my moms and pops, especially the moms and pops of businesses, they look for the easiest, cheapest route. And I know that even local businesses here, there was a brand new business, a goods store just opened up locally with their new warehouse here in my area. And they use Xfinity Wi-Fi for their internet. They don't even have Wi-Fi themselves. They don't even have their own. But like Chris said, they're still backhauled by something, right? And so there still could be regulation there. But I'm still in the belief that wireless technology will continue to get better. Compression and other things will be better there, and they'll figure out the spectrum thing. And they're already starting to figure that out. And the fact that it'll never be as good as a hardline, sure, that's true, but it'll get good enough to the point where people just don't want wires anymore. They just don't want to do it. They don't want to pay the companies for it. It's easier to get these other, they don't have to get hardware for it. I bought some local, new Wi-Fi router, and in fact, Xfinity Wi-Fi was actually clearer in my house than this ridiculously cheap Wi-Fi router. So I think, the things are getting better, and I do agree. Like, I totally get the idea of the speed and the backbone and having the wired stuff. But from the normal consumer, they don't care about that stuff, right? They just want to get good connectivity, and get speeds enough for them to do what they need to do.
Yeah, indeed. All right, let's get to the hopeful part, because we promised hope. We promised hope to our audience, especially those who might be smarting from yesterday's decision. Chris, what are the practical things that our group here might be able to do to help along the buildup of municipal networks? Because I think most of us will agree that it's a good idea, at least to have it in motion. What are the steps that we can take, either advocacy or actually physically starting something up, that could start this process in my town?
Well, I think we need to have conversations with our neighbors. And this idea of broadband and beers, I think, is a very appealing idea that will work most places. In Utah, you could certainly aim for more of a tea and beers or something like that. I'm sorry, I substituted the wrong part, T in broadband.
T in broadband.
Now, there's an interesting video that's come out recently, which would be wonderful for people to hold a screening of locally. You know, if you rent out a room, probably after you get a few beers with people, have a few meetings, you know, advertise on social media. You can get this video. If you do a quick search for Do Not Pass Go, a documentary that's available on Vimeo, the people who did it are happy to give out screening licenses for people to use it. You cannot watch it by yourself right now, but if you organize a screening, you can do it. I was participated in the interviewing process when they were working on it. I don't think I show up anywhere in it, but I've seen the video four or five times. It's remarkable. And there's a little preview you can see, but it's like a 23-minute video that talks about municipal broadband and what one town did and how they had tremendous odds in North Carolina with the state trying to stop them. So they organized around it, and videos like that will help. If you're in the Denver area, there's people who are just starting to talk about this right now because Longmont and Fort Collins are building networks. Longmont's already finished with this great network. What that means is we're in a better position than we were 5 years ago, because if you were in Longmont, you had to do something that was kind of new for the region. But now if you're nearby, you can try and hook into Longmont's service. It's much more feasible for smaller communities around there to do it. You know, Boulder's thinking about this. But many cities have people that are thinking about this sort of process. And we try to make as much information as is more available on muninetworks.org so people can learn more about it. But it's fundamentally about talking to people you know, using social media to talk to more people about what can be done, and then getting a sense of what solution might be right for your community. You know, in San Francisco, there's a big discussion right now, and with Supervisor Farrell pushing this idea of citywide municipal broadband that would be working with local providers like Sonic that are doing a great job, and Monkey Brains. You know, you have to plug into those conversations and make sure they go the right way, because Comcast and CenturyLink, well, Comcast and AT&T in that case, they're fighting really hard to shut that down. So people need to start plugging in, organizing, getting a sense of what's going on in their community by talking to each other.
I do have to mention that Sonic is a sponsor of the This Week in Tech Network. But over to you, Lou.
Thank you. So I think I had one question. I think one thing that, you know, that you kind of talked about having, you know, beers and talking internet. I think, you know, my local town here, you know, 15,000 people or so, you know, we've had several meetings, a lot of people from Amazon and Google and Facebook and Microsoft. They all live in town, Boeing. And so they're very tech savvy. They've gotten together. And we've gotten to the point where the community is good on paying extra either in their HOA or in their taxes for the extra municipal internet. They're actually fine with that because local businesses, people need to work from home, that kind of thing. And in fact, the Pacific Northwest closes down when it snows here, so people want to stay home and do their work. So, but you know, community is not the problem. And so, I guess my question back to you, Chris, is, you know, what is the plan? Because a lot of local governments, for instance, convincing the councils here that in order to put this on the ticket to get money for municipal internet versus maybe putting it into infrastructure or expanding on for businesses or helping schools, you know, how do you convince, you know, what's the plan that these local organizations actually do? Do they have to market? Is it, there's a lot of effort there. Is there a high barrier entry for that?
Yes, you're asking really good questions, and you're absolutely right about the challenges, particularly, I think, for people who aren't really sure what all the options are. So one of the first things I tell people is you don't have to necessarily assume you're going to pay more in taxes to make something like this happen. It is true that if you want to try and build a citywide network to everyone offering gigabit connectivity over the next year or two, you probably are going to have to borrow on the order of $1,000 per person in town or $2,000 per premise. That's a ballpark figure that'll give you roughly order of magnitude cost. But there's also other things you can do. In Lincoln, Nebraska, they dropped $700,000 on conduit and lease that out. That's generated revenue. So there are options that you can do that are actually going to raise money for the city that can be a net income positive approach. And those are the sorts of things that one can start doing right away, even before you're deciding whether or not to commit to a more aggressive plan. So the first thing is to make sure the elected officials know that you're not going to come and ask them to take a hard vote on a very expensive project without being properly educated, that they should consider a continuum of options. But when you do that, you also want to have other citizens at your back. You want to have local businesses saying, this is something that we need. And let's be clear, let's make sure that they actually need it. I've no doubt that they do in your community. There may be communities that are well served already. So you want to make sure that you have businesses saying, yes, this is a need that we need to take care of. And that will put pressure on the elected officials. Now, you also want to make sure you have at least one elected official that's on board before you really start going public and making a big deal out of it. It's always helpful to know if the mayor or a city council member or city council president is going to be sympathetic and supportive of the idea. The other thing you want to do is approach city staff, because a city attorney, a city manager that is really opposed to this or just scared because it comes out of nowhere, they can also stop a project pretty easy. So you want to do a little bit of homework. You want to educate folks, and then you want to make sure people understand that this is something you can go into with your eyes open without making a rash commitment too quickly. I hope that helps a bit. Does that cover some of your questions?
Yeah, absolutely. I think these are the types of things that, it's just tough to figure out. I think as a community member, I would just prefer not to be able to pay lots and lots of gabs of money to have really low quality of service from an internet company and just be able to do it locally and, not have to deal with some of these things going forward. And sometimes it's really tough to figure out how to get started. So this is very helpful. Thank you.
Great. And there's one other video I'd plug also that I think I really like because I did it. It's about Ammon, Idaho, where they built their own network. And we may have talked about that. I think you excerpted a brief piece of it in the March show. But it's a video we did about Ammon's network, where they're financing it, where the city's not taking any risk. And people who are interested themselves, they write a check. And that's a different way of going about it. I'd write a $2,500 check for a one-time fee to get better internet forever. There's a fair number of people who are like that. So that may be an option for some communities.
I love this discussion because anytime you can start by saying, hey, look, talk to your community. This is not a top-down approach. This is a bottom-up. Do they believe that they would be better served if they had more consistent, less expensive broadband, if they had more decisions, more say in how it's used? And I don't think there's a lot of people who would say no to that unless they're just being contrarian. I think we all recognize that the telcos probably don't serve us as good as they could and that they probably take a bit too much profit. So, yeah, Chris, this is awesome. That's exactly what I was hoping to hear. And hopefully that gives hope to our audience. Folks, I want to keep talking to Chris. Unfortunately, we do have to let him go. Chris, can I say this? It was way too long since your last appearance. This is going to be a hotter and a hotter topic as we go into the new year. Can we bring you back periodically to get updates about this movement? Because as of Colorado, there are now more than 200 cities in the United States, or towns, municipalities, that are in the various stages of either thinking about deploying or voting on deploying a municipal network. It would be nice to have an expert, someone with boots on the ground, to actually give us an update.
Yes, I'd be happy to do that. And I can try to suggest other folks as well who may have a better voice than I do, people who have different experiences, to try and get a good mix. We're always happy to try and make those connections.
If you can get enough of them, I'll find the people on the other side and we can have a good old-fashioned cage match. Well, but civilized. Cage match.
Right. I just wanted to make one final point, which is I think something you understand, but I want to make sure people understand. I do not propose driving Comcast out of the market. Right. Like you said, we're looking for competition. And I think communities are better served when they have choice in a variety of levels. So my particular motivation is not to try and establish local, publicly owned monopolies. So I'd like to try and make that clear.
Exactly. It's all about the competition, because we know competition makes things better. We've been speaking with Christopher Mitchell from the Institute of Local Self-Reliance. He is the director of the Community Broadband Network Initiative. You're going to be hearing from him and his group a lot more in 2018, would be my guess. Christopher, one last chance. If you could tell the folks where they can go to find out more about the ILSR, more about the Broadband Initiative, more about you.
Yes, our website for the whole organization is Institute for Local Self-Reliance. It's ilsr.org. Our work on broadband is focused on muninetworks.org, short for municipalnetworks.org. We do a ton of work on co-ops if you're from more rural areas as well. And for more information about me, I'm on Community Nets at Twitter, and that's mostly broadband related, but occasionally I go off on something else.
Always a pleasure, always an honor. Thank you very much for joining us, and we'll have you back.
Thank you.
Folks, when we come back, it's time to bring in, well, a little guest from VMware who's going to explain how you can protect yourself. But before we do that, let's go ahead and take a moment to thank another sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Now, this episode is brought to you by Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Now, the mortgage experience wasn't keeping up. You know that, right? I mean, we live in a digital age. We live in an age where everything should be accessible on our phones. And yet the mortgage process required me to go into a bank and give them a box filled with old receipts and pay stubs to have some complete rando decide whether or not I was worthy of a loan from that financial institution after a long process that could take weeks, if not months. Folks, you don't have to put up with that anymore because Quicken Loans decided that they were going to update that experience and they gave us Rocket Mortgage. Rocket Mortgage gives you the confidence you need when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home loan. Oh, it's simple. It allows you to fully understand all the details and be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. It's convenient. Their trusted partners allow you to share your financial information with Rocket Mortgage at the touch of a button. It's all digital. It's powerful. Whether you're looking to buy your first home or your 10th, Rocket Mortgage is able to perform thousands of calculations in just seconds. And with those calculations, based on your income, your assets, and your credit, Rocket Mortgage can analyze all of the home loan options for which you qualify and then find the one that's just right for you. It's Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. You apply simply, understand fully, and mortgage confidently. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/enterprise. That's rocketmortgage.com/enterprise. Equal housing lender license in all 50 states. NMLS, consumeraccess.org, number 3030. And we thank Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Let's get to my favorite part of the show. That's when we bring a guest in to drop some knowledge on the Twilight Riot. And folks, we've got a good guest for you today, Mr. Chris Cord. He is the Senior Director of Security Product Management for VMware. Chris, thank you very much for joining us on This Week in Enterprise Tech.
My pleasure, Robert. Thanks for having me.
Now, of course, security is always going to be a very specialized section of any company's efforts to push out a product. What is your responsibility at VMware?
Yeah, so I run product management and strategy for what we refer to as our security products team. So essentially, we're a group of focused experts in the security space. The team was formed about 3 years ago, really to enable our customers to use the hypervisor and the virtualization layer in a unique way for solving security challenges. So really double down on what we've done with micro-segmentation and network virtualization.
Now, let's break that down even further, because specifically the product that I'm aware of, that I know that VMware offers, is App Defense. Now, if you were to describe App Defense to someone who's maybe just getting into this and figuring out how VMware can help with their security side, how would you pitch it? How would you explain what App Defense does?
Sure. Yeah. App Defense essentially provides data center, endpoint, and application security using the hypervisor as a way of enforcing what we refer to as least privileged security. So think of it as essentially enforcing a known good state or known good behavior versus chasing bad and trying to hunt malicious behavior, which is traditionally what you would see with most security vendors.
Okay, I like that. Ensuring good rather than trying to block bad. But how does that actually work? Because I know how to block bad. I look for signatures. I look for bad behavior. I look for applications and services accessing resources they should not have access to. But how do you ensure good? It seems like a very different mindset for security.
Sure. Yeah. So I'd argue that you know how to try to block bad. Unfortunately, it doesn't work as well as everyone would like. And the simple reason for that is, malware is constantly changing. Attacker techniques are constantly moving. So you're in a situation where you're pretty much behind the eight ball all the time. And attacker techniques are usually ahead of the methods in which you can try to block them. So what we do is, traditionally just enforce what's known in security realm as least privileged security. So this is, a relatively old principle. It's one of the most tried and true security principles out there. And effectively what it means is we are going to model the way your application should be behaving. And in the data center, your environment doesn't necessarily shift and move and adjust the way you would traditionally see with an end user computing asset, right? So given the fact that we can model the effective known good state of your data center application, we can monitor that and enforce that and start to watch for deviations or anomalies away from that behavior, right? So effectively, it's continuously watching to make sure that we're not seeing anything different than what we expected to see when the application was first initiated.
Any other company would just call this machine learning. You, of course, you've got your special sauce. It's this whole idea of being able to learn what good behavior actually looks like. How much data do I actually have to give the solution before it figures that out? So let's say I've got my mythical 10,000 seat enterprise and I need it to learn what the baseline looks like. How much leeway do I have before the endpoint actually figures out what should be allowed and what shouldn't?
Yeah, the important thing is that we're not really trying to guess or reverse engineer what appropriate behavior is, right? So we do use machine learning. We use it in a very focused way, which is really about validating or verifying the behavior that we're seeing. But our technique is really much more built around leveraging existing sources of data center automation and data center knowledge, right? So in modern software-defined data centers, there are a lot of configuration scripts, automation scripts, other things that are very declarative in terms of the way the environment should behave. And that's not for security reasons. That's typically because, you know, people just want to operate and run the environment. You know, think about things like Kubernetes and things like Puppet or Chef or Ansible, all these tools that are built around automation and configuration management of data centers. So what we do is we actually feed in or take data from those environments. And every time that we see configuration events happening or provisioning events happening on the infrastructure, we pull that in as sources of what we refer to as, you know, known good intended state behavior. And then we use ML to really validate that what we're seeing at runtime is appropriate for what we expected to see. But we don't try to guess your known intended state. We try to use the known good sources of data that already exist.
I like that. So you're looking at the actions of the authorized admins to say these are the things that should be allowed. That brings up another question, though, which is what could this solution do against perhaps people who are not doing their jobs? If I have an admin who goes rogue.
Sure. That's essentially where the verification steps come in, right? So, you know, we treat sources of data like provisioning data, configuration data, as relatively authoritative sources of information, meaning that your administrators have asked for a certain piece of software to be installed on a machine. In App Defense, anytime we get that source of information, the security team still has to verify or approve that intended state, meaning that they might see something being requested, but they have to go through a verification step to say, okay, I'm publishing or officially blessing this known good state. And again, that's where the ML comes in, because we kind of give them some hints of, you know, this is normal, this is expected, this is unexpected, but essentially allows them to be a governing body, so to speak, over the published configuration state.
I'd like to get your take on how this might help. If I was going to use App Defense, fix that conflict that an enterprise will always have between the application/service team and the security team. Because there's a natural conflict, because the security people want to lock everything down and the app people, the service people, want to actually make the network useful. So if I were to implement App Defense on, say, my NSX with a hybrid deployment, how do I use your product to make sure that both of those teams get the proper input into how things actually work on my network?
Yeah. So I think what you're seeing, generally speaking, today is that infrastructure teams, application teams are moving faster and faster and faster, right? So there's all kinds of cool and interesting tools out there to increase the level of automation and speed that infrastructure and application teams have. Security is typically, you know, playing this traffic cop type of role, and oftentimes seeing as not supporting the level of speed and innovation that the business wants to have, because they need to be ensuring that the environment's appropriately protected. So with App Defense, what we essentially allow for, given the fact that we hook into these automation systems, is we sort of give security this constant window into the environment and how it's updating, changing how it's being configured, that allows the security team to basically be in constant contact, so to speak, with the provisioning events happening, right? So it really enables them to let the infrastructure team move as fast as they need to without burdening them with manual security audits or manual security reviews, which is what they're doing today, but still allowing them to effectively get visibility into what's happening, see any potential anomalies in behavior, and also lock things down in a least privileged posture when they feel comfortable that they fully understand the environment. So we think it's actually a pretty good win-win in both scenarios for either team.
Right. Chris, unfortunately, I know you have a hard out, and this is entirely our fault. We ran a little long on a previous program, but I do want to give you an opportunity to maybe share with our audience a little pitch. If they're looking at deploying, if they're looking at maybe bringing VMware into their operational sphere, what is the pitch you would give for App Defense? And what are the efficiencies that you would say you could bring into the deployment process that maybe they wouldn't see elsewhere?
Yeah, I think the most important thing to consider is, I think the model that we are all facing today, which is essentially asking security people to reverse engineer a bunch of signals that they're getting throughout the environment and throughout the data center, and basically triage these events and these alerts on a regular basis, unfortunately, is a really broken model. So while it seems to be the Band-Aid that we're using to sort of patch over the environment and hoping for the best, I think what we've seen with all the recent breach activity, it's just not a very effective method of securing the environment. So I would argue that, you know, we should all be looking to go back to basics a little bit and really ensure some good security hygiene from the ground up. And enforcing a least privileged environment in the data center is really the best method in which to do that. And we think that by embedding things like App Defense, NSX, and other tools directly into the infrastructure, we can actually be much better off in operationalizing this least privileged concept, right? And we've proven that, I think, with micro-segmentation in the network and NSX. And I think we can further prove that with App Defense at the application layer, to really enable just a more secure posture from the ground up inside your data center.
Well, you've been speaking with Mr. Chris Cordy. He's the Senior Director of Security Product Management for VMware's Network and Security Business Unit. Chris, this was way too short. I'm going to say it right now. This is unfair. I want to bring you back. I would like to have you back with the full cast when we get Chibert back, when we've got Lou in the mix, when we can do a real panel. Would you be willing to come back on and help sort of expand our knowledge about App Defense?
Yeah, 100%. Anytime. I'd love to come back and chat.
Chris Cord, thank you very much. Now, if you could please tell the folks at home where they can find you, where they can find VMware's App Defense, where they can find all the information they may want to have before they make the decision about their next deployment.
Sure. Yeah. So you can find all our information online at vmware.com/appdefense. And you can certainly reach out to me. You can reach out to me directly on Twitter if you want. I'm at Chris Cord. Or you can just send us a note. It's appdefense_support@vmware.com. And we'll certainly answer all the questions that you have.
Chris Cord, I promise we will have you back ASAP in the new year. It's been an absolute pleasure. I was looking very much forward to this panel, and I'm so, so upset that we had to cut it short. But thank you for spending even this time with the Twilight Riot.
Anytime, Robert. Thank you.
Folks, that's right. You've done it again. You've used up another hour listening to the best dang enterprise podcast in the universe. That's according to 9 out of 10 virtual machines. I want to thank everyone who makes this show possible. Of course, I have to thank my co-host, Lou. Lou, this is a strange episode because we normally get a panel discussion after the main guest. But, this has still been a lot of fun. And I do want to thank you for all the insight you bring to the show. Could you please tell the folks at home where they can find you, where they can find the work that you do?
Absolutely. You can always find my work at dev.office.com. And you can always check me out on twitter.com/LouMM. I like to post my projects and things I'm working on there.
All right. Fantastic. And as always, I have to thank you. That's right. Our loyal audience. Without you, we don't have a show. You come back every single week to listen to some enterprise goodness. And we thank you for that. And we want to make it a little bit easier by sending you to our show page. Just go to twit.tv/twiet. That's T-W-I-E-T. This Week in Enterprise Tech. There you'll find all of our back episodes as well as the notes for every episode. If you want to find out more about a guest that we spoke with or a product that they discussed or maybe the links for the stories that we cover at the top of the show, it's all at twit.tv/twiet along with a little drop-down menu. This is a secret that we like to not keep secret, and that is you can subscribe to the show. You can get audio, video, or high-definition video automatically into your device of choice. It's the best way to support the show and the best way to grow it. So please, again, twit.tv/twiet. Also, don't forget that you can find me on Twitter at twitter.com/PadreSJ. It's a great place to go if you want to find out more about what I do here at Twit, when I'm not in the studio. Finally, I want to thank everyone here who keeps the bits running. Of course, that's our engineering crew, John and Burke and Alex, and my excellent TD, Kevin the Shark. Now, Kevin, as always, we have to end the show with a opportunity for redemption by asking you something about the show. And, this one's super, super easy. What does ILSR stand for?
In life, super real.
Oh, no, I'm sorry.
Or Institute for something.
No. You only get one answer, and I'm afraid you just didn't do it this week. Thanks anyways. Folks, I'm Father Robert Ballister, the Digital Jesuit, just reminding you that if you want to know what's going on in the Enterprise, just keep twiet.